and conduct military exercises along Russian borders. In his speech at the parade, Russian President Vladimir Putin talked about the ongoing attempts in the world to justify the crimes of the Nazis, recalled the actions of NATO in Ukraine, and explained the reasons for the military action in Donbass.
Страна НАТО не захотели нас услышать.
The NATO countries did not want to hear us, which means that in fact they had completely different plans, and we saw it. Openly, preparations were underway for another punitive operation in the Donbas, an invasion of our historical lands, including Crimea.
Putin has defended the offensive against Ukraine, describing it as a preemptive measure.
Кто разгромил нацизм?
We saw how the military infrastructure is being developed, how hundreds of foreign advisors began to work, regular deliveries of the most modern weapons from NATO countries were going on. The danger grew every day. Russia gave a preemptive rebuff to aggression. It was a forced, timely, and only correct decision, the decision of a sovereign, strong, and independent country.
And after the traditional military parade on Red Square, the president led the People's Parade. Starting 2015, the Immortal Regiment Parade is held in hundreds of Russian-inhabited localities from Kaliningrad to Vladivostok and in other countries. It became the most significant emotional event, as there is no family that has remained unaffected in Russia. All who remember and honor their own veterans of the Army and Navy, partisans, resistance fighters, home front combatants, Nazi concentration camp prisoners, come out with a picture of their beloved, those who fought or gave their lives for liberation of the USSR and Europe.
In Russia, Victory Day remains the most important public holiday of the year. It is equally revered in many of the former Soviet republics. The Great Patriotic War, which started for the Soviets in 1941, united the entire nation and still remains a centerpiece of Russia's consciousness.
Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The Palestinian conflict is the longest-running conflict on record for the United Nations. Multiple attempts at reaching a lasting peace have been and gone. Now, conveners of the Convivencia initiative have spent years poring over a new document that they hope will become the blueprint for a movement that will push for a just peace for Palestinians.
People forget that for almost 2,000 years, Jews, Christians, and later Muslims lived in total harmony in Palestine. The Jews in Palestine were Palestinians. There was no division, there was no racism, there was no anti-Semitism. All these are European inventions.
The vision of stepping away from violence in Palestine and the region can only work if movements for peace are supported by genuine reconciliation and justice at their heart. Now, this bold new initiative being launched in London is putting true solidarity between Muslims, Christians, and Jews at its foundation and hoping for global success.
The suspicions around interfaith dialogue have also been an obstacle.
It was perhaps the first time I've seen something with a vision for Palestine, bringing together Jews, Muslims and Christians here in the UK and abroad, working together for justice and peace in Palestine. Because too often, interfaith dialogue is what I call lowest common denominator. I've been involved in activities with Jewish groups where they say, well, we can't talk about Palestine, or we can't talk about the settlements. And therefore, it shuts down genuine conversation about the causes of the justice in Palestine.
Obviously, without justice and equality and freedom for the Palestinians as well as the Jewish-Israeli inhabitants of that area, there can never be a proper peace. If there's not peace in the Middle East, we know that, unfortunately, there are ramifications for the rest of us in all our societies.
With a growing list of supporters, the hope is to spread the spirit of convivencia.
Even a little child understands justice. If we don't stand against injustice and support each other, what's the point of coming together? And this is really a challenge to create a better future for ourselves, for our children, not just in Palestine, but everywhere else.
For far too long, division has defined the ongoing crisis. But this new initiative is forging the path to a united and just solution for Palestine and the world. Amina Taylor, London.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger, to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift, let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
What does Syria's hard-fought status in both political and military arenas mean in the context of regional countries who used to act against it with the support of the U.S.? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how Syria's re-entrance into the region has been embraced by regional countries, which spells the end of U.S. dominance and influence. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Elijah Magnier joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Also joining us is Marcus Papadopoulos, author, historian, and political analyst from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. If I may first start with you, Elijah Magnier, and get your reaction to what Iran's leader has said. Quote, today, Syria is not the same Syria that it was before the war. Syria enjoys a higher degree of respect and credit, and all countries look upon it as a power.
Thank you for having me. Syria is one of the rare countries who refused to normalize with Israel and declare Israel as an enemy and supported the Palestinian cause and refused to submit to the U.S. hegemony, notwithstanding the war waged on Syria since 2011. That's a very important point. Secondly, Syria is part of the axis of the resistance that reject the U.S. hegemony and fight for the oppressed people and to support the Palestinian cause and refuse any truce with Israel or normalization of the relationship like other countries in the Gulf. Third, the number of countries that were involved in the war in Syria, dozens of nations led by the U.S. to change the regime and create a failed state and allow the jihadists that were trained by the Americans and their NATO allies in Syria, in Jordan, in Turkey, this is a big victory for Syria and its allies, mainly Iran and Russia, who interfered in the war in Syria to the request of the government in Damascus in different stages in 2011, 2013, and 2015. That is very significant. Today, Syria has a different position where different Middle Eastern countries are trying to normalize the relationship and bring them back as they were before 2011, but they are forbidden by the Americans to regain this relationship. And Syria is not rushing toward them, is reinforcing the relationship with Iran that holds more or less the same ideology and objectives against the Israelis, and to support the oppressed, supporting the access of the resistance and rejecting any U.S. hegemony mm-hmm. over the country.
So, Marcus Papadopoulos, how do you go from what, as our guest there said, it's really incredible if you think about it, how many countries were involved in this war on Syria and how they really just went all out for so many years, to now Syria being received by these countries. Of course, we can talk about the UAE, which has warmly embraced Syria, both the foreign minister visiting Syria and then Assad visiting the UAE. And these are, of course, Arab countries that were backing this these terrorists. Why are they welcoming Syria now?
The victory of the Syrian people in the war waged against them by the West through Western proxies, namely numerous terrorist groups, constituted a turning point, not just for the Middle East, but for the world as a whole. Though we should be mindful that not all of Syria has been liberated by the Syrian army, because there are two NATO countries inside Syria and illegally occupying Syrian territory. Thus, in the northeast, we have the Americans, and in the northwest, we have the Turks together with Al-Qaeda. But nevertheless, the victory of Syria really was quite astonishing, given everything that the Americans, the British, the French, the Turks, the Saudis, and the Israelis confronted the Syrian people with, not just in terms of the tens of thousands of terrorists which were deployed into Syria, but also the array of weaponry which was sent to them. So it really was a remarkable victory. And what we can say is this, that as a result of Syria's victory, an unofficial alliance comprising Syria, Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah has emerged in the Middle East. And that unofficial alliance is now confronting American supremacy in the Middle East. And whilst I'm not saying that the American stranglehold over the Middle East is on the verge of collapse, nonetheless, the Syrians, the Iranians, the Russians, and Hezbollah are able to limit the maneuvering of the Americans in the Middle East, which is good for peace in the Middle East, it's good for stability in the Middle East, and it means the Americans don't have the same kind of maneuverability to instigate another war in the Middle East as they have done on previous occasions.
Well, all of this comes, as you mentioned, I think Elijah Magner alluded to, in the face of the U.S., who says that it still stands against this, what it has called normalization, with what it considers to be the regime in Syria, as the U.S. Claims. They have slammed attempts, for example, by the UAE to have started this process, and they have said, as we have said it before, this administration will not express any support for efforts to normalize or to rehabilitate Bashar al-Assad. How is it that you have an ally like the UAE of the U.S., if I may say that? I mean, I'm not too sure if they're on solid footing right now, but how do you go from being an ally to what the UAE has done? Maybe the fallout maybe one of the reasons could be UAE's approach towards Syria.
Well, in politics, everything is possible. There aren't any swear enemy forever, including Saudi Arabia. The investment that Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Qatar have made in Syria in supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS is huge. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars, as the Qatari foreign minister said in one of his interviews a couple of years ago. So today we see the Emiratis already establishing a diplomatic relationship with Damascus since a couple of years now. However, they are prevented from increasing and turning this diplomatic relationship into commercial relationship. Now, all that is because the Biden administration doesn't have a strategic view of what to do in Syria, and hopefully that will turn in the favor of the Syrian government, where they must start activating the resistance against the Turkish and the U.S. occupation forces, as your guest rightly said, in the north, east, and west. Now, the Saudis also don't have a good relationship with this current U.S. administration. However, there are some lines that are not crossed so far, like returning and regaining relationship with Syria, because they believe that this is a gift to President Assad that the Americans are not yet willing to do, waiting for the Syrian opposition to regain some strength from I don't know where, because they finished. And today we have only Al-Qaeda in Turkey in the north and the American and their proxies, Kurds. So any plan is a failed plan, and they have to be convinced to regain relationship with the central government in Damascus.
Yeah, I almost forgot that there was a Syrian opposition. I'm not too sure how they're getting their funding. Marcus Papadopoulos, what is interesting here is the fact that you have the interest, to say the least, from the UAE to expand its business relation with Syria. And it has actually opened up the doors towards that. We can talk about the telecom sector, I believe, and also in the arena of electricity. But the sticking point here is the fact that you have the U.S. sanctions that are in place. Now, if they move ahead with those, then they will be in breach of sanctions. They're showing a keen interest, UAE, in expanding their relationship in the business arena. So how can they when these sanctions are in place?
Well, politics is a strange business. One day you are at war with another country, and the next day you are trading with that country. Prior to the war in Syria in 2011, Syria had a lucrative trading and business relationship with countries such as Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and UAE. And because the efforts of the West to topple the Syrian government and to impose a pro-Western puppet government in Damascus failed, and failed abysmally, there are countries in the Middle East which wish to resurrect its previous lucrative business dealings with Syria. So as you've already mentioned, UAE is one of them. And I have no doubt that at some point in the future, sooner rather than later, the Saudis will do the same and the Turks will do the same. And I also believe the British and the French will do the same. And as regards possible sanctions on a country such as the UAE, which of course is a strategic partner to Washington, well, we have to bear in mind that whilst the Americans exercise tremendous influence in UAE, I do not believe that UAE is a puppet of the Americans, certainly not like how Serbia or Ukraine is a puppet of the American government. So I believe that UAE sees a very important imperative, an important economic imperative in re-establishing its trade relationship with Syria. And I do not believe that the Americans will impose sanctions on UAE, because the Americans are acutely aware that they do not have the kind of maneuverability in the Middle East that they once had as a result of, as I mentioned earlier, the unofficial alliance of Syria, Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah. The Americans are not going to sanction any of their allies in the Middle East at a time when American mastery in the Middle East is being challenged. That would simply be suicidal for the Americans.
Sure. Well, you know, it's very confusing to know what is the policy, Elijah Magnier, of the U.S. when it comes to Syria. I mean, really, even throughout the war, it was kind of confusing. I think it was categorized as an obsession with Assad being, thrown off for his position to get changed. Kind of like the same way that they're looking at Putin. Nevertheless, a question comes to mind. A, what is the U.S. position now when it comes to Syria and Assad? And B, what right does the U.S. even have to dictate and decide for other countries in the region with whom it should have a relationship with?
Well, first of all, the Americans don't have any right to dictate anything on any country, any sovereign country. However, because they are not accountable, they don't feel they need to ask permission from anyone, including the United Nations. That's one. Two, the Americans, the current American administration is really following what President Donald Trump has done in Syria and in other parts of the world, at the exception of the relationship with Russia. So we saw that he kept the Americans' forces in Syria, and he kept the American forces in Iraq, despite the rejection of the Syrian government and the Iraqi parliament of the U.S. Forces' presence in their respective countries. Now, Biden doesn't have a policy in Syria. He has one very specific policy to try and starve the population by controlling the oil and the food that is represent the biggest supply of the country in the northeast, where the U.S. forces are occupying. And he is also blocking the road and the borders on the Tanf between Syria and Iraq. So when he is doing that and preventing Jordan from regaining relationship with Syria, preventing the Arab Gulf countries from doing so, he is aiming to cripple the Syrian economy. That is his only clear policy. Otherwise, he doesn't have any other policy that is visible apart from that, because, first of all, Russia has defeated the U.S. and NATO in Syria. Iran has defeated the U.S. and NATO in Syria by spoiling their objectives and making sure that they will never reach the objective to create a failed state in Damascus. And thirdly, because Hezbollah became stronger due to the Syrian war. So giving Syria as a reward to Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah, this is not something that the Americans are very much willing to do. That's why they're keeping the forces in the north, and I don't think Biden will withdraw ever from a country without a local resistance.
So we need to connect the dots here between different entities that are involved here, Marcus Papadopoulos, and perhaps he can help us out here. So in terms of looking at the side where we want to see what U.S.'s position is, maybe it's good to bring Israel in here. And the reason why I'm bringing Israel in here is because you have the UAE that has normalized ties with Israel. So the U.S., who knows what's going on in terms of their policy, but Israel has formalized ties with the UAE, who has ties with Syria. So can you please explain to us how these relationship works when it comes to Syria?
Very quickly, the cardinal factor as to why the Americans attempted to overthrow the Syrian government was to eradicate Russian influence and power in the Middle East. Why? Because Syria, historically, has been Russia's eyes and ears in the Middle East. That's why Washington attempted to destroy the Syrian government through the use of terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and ISIS. But as regards to how relations between Israel and a number of countries in the Middle East, Arab countries in the Middle East, have been normalized, such as UAE. Well, that is, in my opinion, America's response to the victory of the Syrian people in the war in their homeland, because the Americans, through getting their allies in the region, such as Israel and UAE, to normalize their relationship with one another, that not only strengthens Israel, but it also, as a result, strengthens America's position in the Middle East. So whilst it is very true that America's position in the Middle East has been weakened somewhat by the victory of Syria in the war, nonetheless, the Americans are still able to bring together their allies in the region as a way of augmenting their mastery in West Asia. No different to how the Americans have formed a partnership in the Eastern Mediterranean involving Greece, Cyprus, Lebanon, Israel, sure, and Saudi Arabia. So we need to be very mindful that the Americans, whilst they've been weakened in the Middle East, they are anything but a spent force there.
Well, I'm sure you agree, Elijah Magner, the way the media is reporting this and the way it's being reported in general in terms of the way that these overtures, if you want to call it, are being done between the Persian Gulf countries and Syria is one key motive, and that is said to stop the influence of Iran with Syria. But we see Assad visiting Iran today, meeting with the leader who received them very warmly. And at the same time, you have the current administration, the 13th administration, headed by Ebrahim Raisi, who has made it a point, A, to establish close ties with regional countries, and B, Iran is in the middle of talks with Saudi Arabia, which there are talks of even the embassies opening up. So if you have that going on, how can there then be a relationship between these Arab countries with Israel, the ones who are formalized, when Israel is bombing Syria? Because they want to make investments in that country. At least that's part of the talk and rapport that they want to establish.
Well, look, we've seen the relationship between Russia and Turkey is a very strategic and excellent relationship, but they disagree on Syria. We've seen also the relationship between Iran and Turkey going into a very good level, but they disagree also on Syria because both Russia and Iran believe in the sovereignty of the Syrian state. Now, the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia is regaining. However, the Saudis are still occupying Yemen and not releasing all the goods to lift the sanctions on Yemen. So there are differences that can be organized in some countries and disagreed upon in other countries. Now, this is going to happen between Saudi Arabia and Iran, the regaining of the diplomatic relationship this month, because that is important, particularly when Iran shows strengths and its ability to stand against the U.S., and the nuclear deal is about to happen anytime if the Americans agree on the full Iranian terms. That's why it is in the advantage of the Saudis to have good ties with a strong country like Iran that is capable of defending them itself and showed its capability, particularly after bombing the Mossad base in Iraq just a couple of weeks ago. Showing the Iranian capability, threatening Israel, and the Saudis having good relationship with Israel, they are two different things. The Saudis are pleasing the Americans. The Saudis are afraid of the Americans' reaction. They want to have good ties with the Israelis, but that doesn't mean the population in the Middle East agree what their leaders are doing, particularly in the Emirate, in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in Jordan. There are different things here.
Well, a final question, Marcus Papadopoulos. So when it came to Syria, Saudi Arabia and the allies and a bunch of countries that were on the same page, they lost that war. When it comes to Saudi Arabia, they have pretty much lost the war in Yemen. I'm guessing that they're saying, okay, it's time to maybe move and regroup with regional countries, Syria being one of them. The resistance, this is part of the resistance of this area, Syria, one part of that equation. When these countries align themselves with Syria, will that be the final blow for the U.S. in a sign that it should move out of the region?
While Saudi Arabia may have lost the war in Yemen, they have still nevertheless slaughtered over 200,000 Yemeni men, women and children through the use of British and American weapons. But the world is witness to the emergence of a very powerful Iranian state. And that is a reality that the Saudis cannot ignore. So the Saudis have two options. They can either have a war with Iran, which would be catastrophic for the Saudis, or they can have some sort of relationship with the Iranians. And that is why I believe that Riyadh will opt for the latter. They will establish some sort of relationship with Iran, because otherwise the Saudis could become embroiled in a war with the Iranians and Saudi Arabia would be decimated and the American hold over the Middle East would be then in serious jeopardy.
Very well. We're going to end it there. Thank you for that, Marcus Papadopoulos, author, historian, political analyst. Elijah McNair, pleasure, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Vitakwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, we have started explanation of Surah Ar-Rahman, which is considered the crown of the Noble Quran, since it opens with the word Ar-Rahman, or the All-Beneficent, thus proclaiming one of the most beautiful attributes of the Almighty Creator. This surah highlights the All-Merciful Lord's wonders of creation, describes the end of the material world, and paints an evocative picture of the delights of paradise. Hell is briefly contrasted in Ayah 43 with the joys that await the righteous. The refrain, فَبِأَيِّ آلَاءِ رَبِّكُمَا تُكَذِّبَانِ, which means, so which of your Lord's bounties will you, both mankind and jinn, deny? Runs throughout the surah. We continue from where we left you in our last episode of this series a fortnight ago, and here are ayahs 14, 15, and 16 of the said surah.
خلق الإنسان من صلصال كالفخار وخلق الجان من مارج من نار فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان.
He created man out of dry clay, like the potter's clay, and created the jinn out of a flame of fire. So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny?
Thank you.
if you might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said that among the divine blessings is the creation of planet Earth with all its wondrous forms of life and inanimate objects as the cradle for the comfort and flourishing of human beings who have been granted different types of provisions to eat and enjoy, such as a variety of fruits and vegetables and grains, including wheat, rice, barley, millets, etc., as well as various fragrant plants and flowers to take pleasure from. Divine bounties encompass all our life and the environment around us, which means the humans and the other somewhat intelligible but invisible species called Jinn should be careful not to deny these blessings, which are irrefutable proofs of God Almighty's omnipotence, graciousness, and mercy. The ayahs that we recited to you now refer to the creation of mankind and Jinn and indicate God's omnipotence, and also provides everyone with lessons saying, mankind has been created from the ingredient salsal, which is Arabic for dry clay, that is molded with a sprinkling of water, like the clay of pottery, as denoted by the Arabic word fakhar, is applied to any kind of pottery which rattles or makes sounds upon being touched. Thus, God Almighty created the human being from a seemingly unworthy matter and granted it intellect and the power of speech, thereby providing mankind the opportunity to become the noblest of all species of creatures by striving towards perfection through the recognition of the manifest truth, and by abstaining from all forbidden and indecent things and acts, including disbelief and ingratitude. Ayah 15 describes the creation of Jinn from the flame of fire, as is evident by the use of Arabic phrase Ma regina menar, which is indicative of the different colors of the flames of a blazing fire, fanned by wind, may assume such as red, yellow, blue, and white. This species, which has been granted moderate intelligence and ability to speak, is invisible to the physical eye of the human being, and is capable of assuming various shapes and sizes, as per the will of God Almighty. Therefore, it is crystal clear that the source of human creation was earth and water, while that of Jinn was fire and wind. Ayah 16 is reiteration of the rhetorical question posed after every few ayahs, as a reminder to make both mankind and genies reflect upon the blessings of the all-merciful Creator by opening their mind's eye and taking stock of themselves and their deeds instead of denying or ignoring such manifest truths. These ayahs teach us that, number one, elements like earth, water, fire, and air have no life of their own or any intellect, and it is the Almighty Creator who molded out of these species of two different creatures and granted them the spirit that regulates their motions and the mind that determines their actions. Number two, mankind and Jinn are both creatures of this planet, formed out of material substances, and are accountable for their beliefs and deeds in view of the gifts of the intellect and speech they have been granted, in order to justify reward or punishment for them. Number three, It is gross ignorance to deny the existence of things that cannot be seen by the physical eye or are hidden from our limited senses, such as the invisible species called jinn or genies. And number four, ingratitude towards divine bounties is a cardinal sin from which both mankind and jinn should abstain. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 17 and 18 of Surah Ar-Rahman.
رب المشرقين ورب المغربين فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان.
Lord of the two Easts and Lord of the two Wests, that is the points of sunrise and sunset at the winter and summer solstices. So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? Ayah 17 draws attention to another divine blessing, saying, God Almighty is the Lord of two Easts and two Wests, which is a reference to the two slightly differing positions the sun seems to assume in the 2 6-month seasonal winter and summer solstices of the year, while rising in the east and setting in the west, as planet Earth orbits around the sun, while rotating on its own axis to determine the day and the night. It could be said that each and every day in a year's time, the sun rises from a point and sets in another. Hence, the number of east and west equals the number of the days of a year. But taking into account the maximum northern and southern axis on the horizon, the broad definition is of two east and two wests. Generally speaking, this ayah reflects the precise order of creation that requires a balanced amount of light, darkness, heat and cold, which is indeed a great blessing of God. That is the reason the next ayah repeats the rhetorical question, so which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? From these ayahs, we learn the following points. Number one, the Noble Quran, revealed by the Almighty Creator almost a millennium and a half ago, gives a wondrous description of the sky, the celestial bodies, and the nature of the earth, which modern science is now trying to discover through trial and error. Number two, the seasonal cycle, the differing duration of days and nights, and the varying degrees of heat and cold throughout the year are not accidental, but function according to a precise plan determined by the divine administrator of the universe. And number three, truth is undeniable even if the disbelievers and the ingrates try to ignore it. Listen to ayahs 19, 20 and 21 of the same surah.
مرج البحرين يلتقيان بينهما برزخ لا يبغيان فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان.
He merged the two seas, sweet and salty, meeting each other. There is a barrier between them, which they do not overstep. So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? These ayahs point to the fact that among the blessings of God Almighty is the creation of two distinct types of water bodies. One of palatable water and the other bitter and unpalatable, yet both are productive. Although these waters meet each other, they do not intermingle, since there is a discrete barrier between them, as could be visible from a bird's eye view or seen from a height. This spectacle is clearly evident at the estuaries where rivers of fresh water flow into the large seas of salt water, drawing a clearly visible line at the meeting point due to different degrees of thickness of the two that gives them a distinct shade of color, in addition to their respective warmth or cold that keeps their joint flow separate and affects the climatic conditions of the adjoining lands. Ayah 21 is again a warning to mankind and jinn against denial of divine blessings. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number 1. The world of nature, including the water bodies and the ecosystem, is a manifestation of the Almighty Creator's infinite power and mercy. Number 2. The perfect order of the natural environment that enables life to flourish on planet Earth requires both sweet and salty waters. And number 3, the human beings and the jinn are again cautioned against indulging in disbelief and denial of divine blessings. We present to you ayahs 22, 23, 24, and 25 of Surah Ar-Rahman in conclusion of this Friday's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment.
يَخْرُجُ مِنْهُمَا اللُّؤْلُؤُ وَالْمَرْجَانُ فَبِأَيِّ آلَاءِ رَبِّكُمَا تُكَذِّبَانِ وله الجوار المنشآت في البحر كالأعلام فبأي آلاء ربكما تكذبان.
From them emerge the pearl and the coral. So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? His are the sailing ships or watercrafts on the sea appearing like landmarks. So which of your Lord's bounties will you both deny? Ayah 22 means to say that among the many yields of the two types of water bodies, both sweet and salty, where abundant fish thrive, are pearls and corals that are used as ornaments, in addition to their medical use and several other benefits accrued from them. Pearls differ in quality depending on their size, luster, and shades of mostly white or cream color, while the best kind of coral is red, and the darker the better. We should not deny these manifest divine bounties. Ayah 24 refers to the important role of the rivers, the seas, and the oceans through which sail vessels of various types, including large ships built by human beings, through proper use of the brain and the brawn gifted by God for travel and transportation of merchandise between different lands. Then, how can we deny the bounties and blessings of our merciful Lord? From these ayahs, we learn that, number 1, although mankind is land-based, the watercourses, including lakes, rivers, seas, and oceans, serve as sources of sustenance and development. Number 2. It is the power of the brain, coupled with physical strength, which enable human beings to build ships and other means of travel and transportation on land, sea, and in the air. And number 3. The disbelievers and the deniers are thus in gross ignorance to neglect such manifest signs of divine favors.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.